And also, do you want me to just make different the lights or something? Do you want me to do... There's lots of different light options.
I don't know.
Just whatever you want. It's fine.
What's that?
I mean,
I think we can stand. Behind
stand.
The table seems very, yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I think that's good.
It seems very horrible, doesn't it? They always schedule things.
Attention, we're going to get started. My name is Melanie Sage. I work in the Alumni and Parent Programs Office here at Amherst, and I'm very honored today to introduce you to our two guest speakers. First, we have Katherine Sanderson, who's an Associate Professor of Psychology here at Amherst College. Katherine's research examines influences on health-related behaviors such as safer sex and disordered eating, and the predictors of satisfaction in close relationships. She's published over 25 journal articles and book chapters, in addition to writing textbooks on health psychology and social psychology, and a popular press book on parenting, Slow and Steady Parenting. Our second speaker today is Pam Allen, a member of the class of 1984. Did I get that right? Okay. Pam is the director of Lit Life, an internationally recognized organization bringing resources for the teaching of reading and writing to schools and families. She is also the founder of Lit World, which campaigns for global literacy. In Books for Boys, a foster care literacy initiative, Pam's book, What to Read When, The Books and Stories to Read with Your Child, and All the Best Times to Read Them, is the 2009 National Parenting Association Gold Medal winner. Welcome.
I think we both had sort of the same vision, was that we really wanted this to be informal, that we didn't want to be at a lectern, that we didn't even want to sit, and we wanted it to be very casual. So I think our preference is to make it very informal, to make it a conversation with people in this room and each other.
Yep, definitely. Well, one thing I was thinking is just in terms of the title of our talk and thinking about the work that you do and reading your book, Slow and Steady Parenting, and thinking about all of us, either as parents or as people who are working with children. There are a couple of people in this room that I know have worked with me over at Children's Village doing work with foster care kids. So even those of you who aren't yet parents or maybe relating to children in all kinds of different ways, this idea of let's expand the idea of parenting to include everyone who's touching children and all the different ways that we can do that. And I have found for myself that literature, children's literature, we're so lucky in this country, particularly, to have so many fine authors who write for children. And now worldwide, hopefully more and more and more global literature that represents children's voices and the experiences of children. But what I found is that the literature itself tells the story of childhood. And one thing I was thinking that, Katherine, you might find interesting is for some of the research I did for my book, just looking at the history of children's literature and how, as children's literature has changed, it not only reflects the way we view children, but also the way we interact with children. So just as a quick example, when Margaret Wise Brown wrote Goodnight Moon, although it seems like a very simple book and it seems like, how could that book be groundbreaking? At the time it was written, it was groundbreaking because it was the first time that a children's book wasn't about a moralistic, I'm going to tell you what to do and you better do it, you know? It was much more about the child's experience and told from the child's perspective. And it was what Margaret Wise Brown may have not been the first one to coin this phrase, but was the first one to make it famous, was called the here and now, that the child experiences that really intensely. And so that Goodnight Moon book that seems so, it's almost... unbelievably simple. You know, you just can't even believe it. You're like, wait, I could have done that. You know, is actually just genius because she captures the essence of what the child is experiencing, the child slash bunny, and the way the room is so big and the bunny is in the bed and all those objects, and the bunny is sort of trying to calm down by saying, okay, hush, hush, hush. You know, Connie, you do wonder who that old lady is whispering hush. Like, I've always wondered, who is she, you know? But at the same time, what she did was she transformed the landscape for anybody who was interacting with children to stop and say, children have a perspective, and the perspective might not be ours. We might be living in the world in a whole entirely different way. And I always find that interesting working with teachers, because teachers will say, we have to do a lot of different activities because kids can't slow down. Speaking of your book, Slow and Steady Parenting, and that kids move so fast. And I think to myself, is that really true? Because when I think of my daughters growing up and how, you know, for years we couldn't even use the couch because they would undo the couch and make it into a castle, and that play would go on for days and days, and you try to go sit down, you can't go there, you know? And that's not fast. That's slow and steady, like you say. I mean, that's really slow and steady. And so that children's literature has done this. It's not just, oh, it's so great to read aloud to your kids, but also what are the lessons that great writers have taught us about childhood and how we learn to see children in different ways that I think can help inform both how we interact with our own child in the home, but also how even legislation is made, you know, how we think about children all over the world, how are we going to take care of children. And just a brief anecdote in that I was in South Africa a couple of summers ago, and I was in a very poor area, a township, where there was just nothing. There was no running water, nothing. And there I saw children playing with a box, a cardboard box, and they had made it into a little house, and they were playing in a little, you know, a little house. And I sat and I watched them for a long time, and I just watched how wisely and well they used the tiniest scrap of thing that they had. And that is really the universal essence of childhood, is they will use what they have. You know, we can give them 1,000 things, but they will use what they have. And what can we do as adults around them, and what are the kinds of offerings we can share with them that will create for them a world that feels whole and feels safe and feels peaceful and feels in that slow and steady way like they're worth listening to, I guess is what I want to say. So children's literature is just a really interesting thing. When you're reading, if you go to the library and you pick up some of these classics, take a look at when they were written, because it's really interesting to see, like, for example, Where the Wild Things Are is also another really groundbreaking book. When that came out, that was another one people, you know, that was banned in libraries, and, you know, people said this book is too dangerous. And somebody asked Marie Sendak, yeah, who, you know, where, how did you base these creatures, these beasts? You know, where did you come up with this horrible idea that you would, you know, expose to children? And he said, what do you mean? These were my relatives in Brooklyn. That's what he said. You know, that's it. And so this guy knew it. And, you know, and the other thing is, and I think you'll appreciate this, is that I love to find out about these authors. And one of the things that has fascinated me for so many years is that almost all of my favorite authors spent a lot of time being sick as children. And I think it's Marie Sendak being one. And I think one of the reasons is they just spent a lot of time sitting and watching. They weren't running to this lesson and that lesson and that lesson and that. They were just sitting there. Mm-hmm. And Marie Sendak writes about his books. He wrote about a little girl named Rosie. And he recalls how he would look out the window while she'd be playing outside because he was not feeling well and he had to be at his couch. And this was one of his inspirations. But not that I think we should all be sick and stay home, please, no. But at the same time, I think that there is a sense of, in literature, of the value of that slowing it down, really paying attention to the depth of experience, and having that be a value that we convey to children, mm-hmm. You know?
So I have three kids. I have a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And I will say that, you know, all of the work that is described in your book, and so some of you, I'm sure, have seen it, but it makes a fabulous baby shower gift, I'll also just say, because it really is talking about the role of literature and the role of literature from very early on and getting kids excited to read. So when I think about my own three kids, I remember thinking through sort of like milestones that I was trying to tick off, you know, and one of them was, of course, toilet training. That was very good. And one of them was learning how to read. That learning how to read and that having the sense of giving a child a book. So my five-year-old is working on it and is working on Hop on Pop, like, as we speak. And is, you know, going through Pup, Pup, oh, that's Pop. And no, that's Pup. And, you know, going through that piece. And the moment at which the child has that. And so then you think about the power of hearing the early words, of hearing the early words. And I remember reading, and I'm sure people here can remember reading and having been read to, Charlotte's Web or... the book about the Mr. Popper's Penguins, The Enormous Egg, that these sorts of books that, you know, were chapter books and were long and, you know, waiting and waiting for the next, you know, the next chapter. No, can we read one more? Can we read one more? So last weekend was Halloween, and I have a five-year-old daughter, and, of course, the popular costume for five-year-old girls is guess what? Right. And she went as Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh,
and she was the only Laura Ingalls Wilder out, and it's a little hard for her to say it, you know. So it was the kind of thing where, and she would say Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, it's like there's that, and people say what, you know, what is that? But it was a costume that my grandmother had made for me that I wore as Laura Ingalls Wilder, and that was because those books I remember being so impactful for me, and the kind of magic for children that my now 11-year-old, you know, never had any interest in boy, never had any interest in. But my 8-year-old, also boy, loved Laura Ingalls Wilder and, in fact, read my books from childhood with the covers coming off and the pages ripped and the sign on the back that said, you know, 99 cents because, you know, that's how much they were, you know, 72 or whenever they were purchased. And I just, it strikes me as, and I think parents here can all relate to, the moment when a child won't put down a book, the child won't stop reading, the child won't, you know, come out for dinner. I remember with my now 11-year-old going into his room at night with a washcloth and taking all of his light bulbs because he were hot, and he wouldn't stop reading. And so it was this thing where, and that was our argument. Our argument was, you know, no, I've got to take the light bulbs because I just don't trust you at all because you will continue to read and you will continue to read. And then it also strikes me as a real challenge, you know, for parents today is there is so much emphasis on TV and video, and so people say, well, I haven't read the Harry Potter books, but my kids have seen the Harry Potter movies. Of course, that's a very different experience, you know, as anyone who's, you know, seen something, you know, loved something in literature and then seen the rendition of it in a different kind of way. And I was reading a piece in the New York Times a week or so ago, which I called my brother, who Pam inscribed a book for in June when we first met. And I said, I just am going to tell you this one thing. Guess what the mean hour, and I'll let people guess here, the mean number of hours of TV watched per week by children ages 2 to 5. So little, tiny kids, I mean, 2 to 5, not yet in school. So the mean hours per week. So it's
40.
You read the article. Yeah, it was 30. It was between 25 and 30. And again, that's a mean. And gosh,
4 hours a day,
and they're sleeping a lot then. So I said to my brother, and I said they have this sort of this graph of, you know, when do the hours watch? And I said, and some of them occur like in the morning. And my brother said, well, to get 4 hours of TV, then you've got to get some in the morning. You know, you can't really accomplish it, you know, unless you can get some done. You know, but it just strikes me as, you know, boy, what a loss is that? What a loss is that? You know, 4 hours of TV a day when you're 3. I mean, just boy.
And I think that also that goes with the idea. I mean, the culture, like you're saying, it's visually bombarding us all the time. All of us, you know. And what I say to parents and teachers and interns, the Amherst students in this audience who are thinking of working with children, that it's for us, too, to turn off the visual and let us create our own visual images, because it's just good for our brains. It's good for everybody. When I read aloud to children, there are books that I, you know, reread, and I love them, and I find them to be fresh each time I go back to them, depending on who I'm reading them to. So you talk about Dr. Seuss, and your son is like having a metaphorical light bulb. The kid still has his metaphorical light bulb, you know, going off to say he can read. At Children's Village, where I do a lot of work, where there are a lot of boys who are much older but reading at very low levels. When we read Dr. Seuss to them, I say to them, this guy, he's a genius. This guy was a genius. He took very few words, and he was able to rhyme them in just unbelievable ways. His editor had said to him, I think he said, you know, I'll pay you $50 if you can take these 50 words and make them into a book. And that became, you know, Cat in the Hat, right? So that's exactly what happened, and he figured it out. And I say to the boys, you know, this book might seem simple, but it's not so simple. Like, how many people do you know who've done this since then, this successfully? Not too many. And so a boy who's 15 or 16 and can't read well then feels validated that I do appreciate that this guy has come up with a way to tell a story so simply with so few words. And yet, even though there's images on the page, which is something so amazing about picture books, there's something about the reading experience that allows us to create these visual images. When television is involved, it is much more subjective to whoever created that show and however they want you to see it and however they want you to interpret it. And it's kind of bossy, you know what I mean? Whereas a book is more, the story is more yours. You can own that thing. You know, the boy that I work with at Children's Village can experience the Dr. Seuss book in a very different way than a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old, but it's still his experience. Nobody can take that away from him. And I think, you know, that is a concern, not just for about television, but about, of course, about the internet itself, because it's so enticing, it's so marvelous. I mean, I love it, you know, my daughter can tell, I love everything. I love Facebook, I love the whole thing, I can't believe it. You know, I just can't get over it. It's like, it's an unbelievable, I'm like, I have thousands of friends, you know? But, I'm no different than the 10-year-old. It's like, and, you know, and I feel like my daughters are like, Mom, you gotta rein yourself in here. Yeah? But I love it because it's print, it's print. And when I've been working in Africa now, people can email me in 1 second. And one of the teachers I work with had a Facebook status message the other day that said, the rains have come, and I'm worried my little house will wash away. And that was her Facebook message. That tells me her story. Those words tell me a story about her life. I would never have had that if not for the internet. And so myself, as a lover of words and a lover of books, I feel much less confident to say to you, turn off the internet, than I do about the TV, which I feel much more concerned that it's the images are bombarding us and we have no control. You know, the clicker isn't even fast enough. Yeah.
You know, I can just add, I'm a child psychiatrist, so I can just add from my perspective that the studies on TV...
Can you hear back there?
The studies that have been done on television... show that because the images are edited by adults who like a lot of quick changes, it tends to shorten a child's attention span, and it's actually a very destructive influence in terms of you're working with kids with ADD and stuff like that. They have the tendency, that television has the tendency to shorten the attention span.
So television having the tendency to shorten the attention span because the adults in charge of it are deciding to make flip the scenes faster and faster.
It's not boring for the adults who are editing. They want to keep changing the images. But the effect that it has on children, and especially the vulnerable population of the ADD population, is it tends to shorten the attention span so that you learn to hop from image to image, but you get used to that quick jump, and you don't really learn to lengthen the attention span.
So for vulnerable kids, it's shortening attention span rather than lengthening it, which goes again to the point about what is, in terms of developing and nurturing the inner lives of children, how literature and storytelling, just storytelling in general, however those stories are being told, has the capacity to lengthen then what happens, which you can't really do when you're not in charge. You can't even talk back to the...
I had a question about I worked in a rural township in South Africa in a primary school, and of course very, very few resources in the school, and all of the books were donated by American volunteers, so all of the books were American books. And I'm just wondering the experience of this young South African poor child reading a book that he can't necessarily relate to. I mean, it's still an incredible experience, but I don't know kind of what perspective you can share.
Yeah, I mean, that actually it's a big part of my concern and my work with my organization, Lit World, is how to create opportunities for people to tell their own stories from their own perspectives that other people can read. And we have this problem even, you know, very much so here in this country, where children pick up a book and say, that's not about my experience, I can't, and also in terms of learning to read, when you're learning to read, it's nice to have some things that are stable. So if you're reading, like if I'm reading a book about snow and I'm learning how to decode those words, I know what snow is, I've experienced it, I felt it, that's good, I've got that taken care of, now let me go and try to decode. Whereas if you're reading a book about something you've never, you know, seen or experienced, then you've got too many things to do. So even in terms of learning to read, that's a problem. I personally feel like the internet and the mobile technology is perhaps going to transform the world in another minute. And that is my hope. I really feel it, because I want to make sure that we can get words to people without this feeling that the only place words come from is here. Do you know what I mean? And so I met this guy in Liberia who, he's doing this thing where he's training local writers to write children's books, and then they're teaching them how to do that, and then they're paying a newspaper publishing place to print the books, and it's so complicated, you can't even believe. And I said to him, well, when are these books going to be ready? And he was like, like 3 to 5 years. And I was like, 3 to 5 years? I mean, we got to move faster than that. So there's no solution at the moment, but you're right. Like, I think, on the one hand, I think there is literature that we should all be reading, global literature. Like, we should all be reading it, not just certain people that we read over and over again. And this is a problem in this country, too. But at the same time, I feel like there's no easy... Like, I still want to put some books on a ship and send them over, because I can't figure out what else to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the role of mythology also for people, is that it becomes the universal journey or the universal story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's about every man, and a lot of the mythology, if you look in different cultures, is about animals. Mm-hmm. So people can always relate to an animal character, even if it's, you know,
yes,
something that's not about mm-hmm. baseball or... You know, something they can't relate to.
That mythology is universal, and also this idea of animal characters, which I agree with too, that in terms of picture books and mm-hmm. relating to children's inner lives, you know, you often wonder how come it is that most great children's literature is about rabbits and muskrats and badgers and all that. And I was talking to a friend of mine, actually an Amherst grad, CBA, who's a children's book editor. And we were talking about a book idea, and about a polar bear, and then I liked this other image of a muskrat. Maybe it was a muskrat. And I said to her, "Oh, it would be really neat to like get them together and have them have a friendship." And she wrote me back, "That would not work. They're not from the same habitat." And I was like, "This isn't real." Like, she's been way too long in that
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. But you know, you gotta love it though. She's you know, it's really serious business. Like, we're writing about the lives of children here, and so we gotta get this right.
Yeah. I think somebody over. Yep.
Just in relation to the computer and reading, when I taught my own son to read, I used the computer to create just pages of his own world. French toast, his grandmother. He wrote his own book and wanted to read it because it was about him. And it was, so, it's an idea of using their world and creating very simple things mm-hmm. that they can relate to that encourage reading and encourage them to learn to read.
There's a great website, which I encourage you all to take a look at, called reallybooks.com, R-E-A-L-E, books.com. And it's a digital library online. You can make very simple online digital books. And very, very simple. You could download from Google Images to bring pictures, or you can put your own, take pictures of yourselves and put them on. And we've been doing that with schools here and schools in Africa to have them exchange stories. But it's free, so you could do it. You can have children go on and just write lots and lots of books. And that, then children are writing about their own experience. And then that becomes, you know, that's also interesting for other children too, to see and to understand and to come to learn about each other.
Yeah. I think a lot of this, in another hat that I have on, I'm also on the school board in Amherst, and that one of the real challenges, as you know well, working with the Crocker Farm Elementary School in particular, is that there are 4 elementary schools in Amherst, and they differ substantially in terms of the population. And one school in particular, where Pam is doing really the most work, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
When the principal of that school is actually also an Amherst alum. And that school has been, in Amherst, 50% low-income children. So even in Amherst, you know, which people often don't think of as having a particular diverse population. And one issue that really occurs to me as a member of the school board that we're really trying to struggle with is that, of course, children arrive at kindergarten in very different places. How many books do they have in their homes? Mm-hmm. How many times has somebody sat up at night and read a book to them? You know, how common is that as part of their experience? And when you think about children arriving in kindergarten, they shouldn't be that different, and yet they are so different in that children enter kindergarten and some are reading. Some are absolutely reading, and some do not know all of the letters, or that letters have sounds, or that letters and sounds together make words, and that just the, sort of the tremendous variation with which kids arrive in kindergarten, and how do we sort of as a community in Amherst, how do we as a community in the United States, as how do we as a community in the world deal with that reality? And I think that's something that I'm really struck by in terms of thinking about the role of literature and how it's very differentially important in different lives and in different families as a function of income and education. We have a fresh air child. Do people know what that is? So a child from the inner city who comes and stays with us for a few weeks in the summer. And so he's come for four summers. He started when he was six. He came this summer and is nine. But I remember the first year that he arrived, so he has this little backpack with his clothes, and his mother had given him things for the bus ride from New York, which is 5 hours, you know, if you go on a fresh air bus. And there were no books in the backpack. You know, there were crayons. You know, there was, a tablet for drawing, and there were snacks. But there were no books. And it just struck me as, you know, imagine, putting a six-year-old on the bus, you would have a book would go in. And so we then started this ritual of the night before he left, we would go to Barnes & Noble, and we would walk around, and, you know, he would pick up a few books to take back. And, you know, that became this sort of ritual, because it just was not something that he was, you know, that had been particularly valued in that home and was not really a part of his life and his experience in that way. And it just struck me as what a difference.
Well, the National Endowment for the Arts just came out with a study last year that said that children who have 10 or more books in their home do substantially better on all standardized tests in school, including math and science and social studies, not just English language arts. And it was such a significant, they accounted for all kinds of, now I'm with a psychology professor, I'm sure I'm like totally, it was a study and yes. It's really good. You know? Anyway, back to what I was saying. No, because really, I'm not good with this. But I will say that the National Endowment of the Arts does have this on their website, and they accounted for socioeconomic differences and all of that, and still found that one element is the one thing, no matter what the other variables. See, I use the word variable.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
I'm a pediatrician, and I've been in practice for almost 20 years, so I have a lot of experience with families in a different way. Mm-hmm. You do, but the one thing that over the years I've been struck with is the first question I ask a family with a newborn is, well, two questions I ask is, one, where is your TV in your house? Mm-hmm. And that makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And how much do you watch TV? Mm-hmm. And they're like, wait a minute, you were supposed to take care of my baby.
Right.
That's fantastic that you do
well,
that.
Well, just over the years, because I found that is the best way.
Can you hear?
Way.
All right.
I heard that.
Okay.
To move TVs from the major center of a family's life. Mm-hmm. And the other way is to ask if the TV's in the kitchen, mm-hmm. because that's a really, I grew up, we never had TV in the kitchen, but I found through the years many people do. And so there's no conversation even. There's all just the TV going while everyone's in a meal. And I say, well, TV can be used as a babysitter. Mm-hmm. If you need to take a shower and you have a 2-year-old, that's perfectly fine. But other than that, it should not be used as thinking it's educational. And in fact, Baby Einstein videos have now, they're giving back money to people because
they're
recalling
them
as educational. Yeah. And they've recalled them.
Yeah, well, you can get your money back. You can get a refund.
Money back.
Yeah, yeah.
You get your money
right,
back.
Right, that's true.
You
know,
get
yeah.
your money back for them because the American Academy of Pediatrics is saying that they, you know, there should be no TV under age 2, and those were sold for 1-year-olds. But I'd love to hear your other ideas. You know, I can tell when I go in a room and I'm, you know, it's quick, you know, with the patient, who are these kids watch more than an hour a day of TV versus kids who are readers. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know what I think also with that is that, Catherine, in your book, when you talk about taking the long view of working or being with children, and I really love that idea because, especially as a pediatrician, if you're talking to parents who are new parents, it's the first time they've ever held a baby even.
They sometimes get mad.
Yeah. Well, but I think
it's not appropriate. And I say it is. You think about it. And next week when you come back, let's talk about it. And you observe how much TV you watch, because a lot of the men, in particular, love sports and want to watch their sports. And they have to recognize what consequence that's going to have on their family life and their children. But it's not easy. I don't know. I just wonder if you have any other ideas from things.
Well, one thing I see that for some families, it's daunting if you yourself did not grow up around a lot of books, and so you say, I know, I think I'm supposed to read to my child, but I myself don't feel like a confident reader. And so one of the things, you know, just in terms of that is to really, in our thinking about how we work with children, is that they are experiencing so much. You don't always have to be in charge when you're reading with a child, but to ask them to tell you the story of that page, or tell you, let's retell what we just read. Or even when you ask children about their school day, when you say to children, you know, how is school today? And you know, they'll go, it was okay. You know, fine, good, like that. And you're like, what do you mean? There were like 6 hours, all this stuff was happening. But I think that story, that's all about storytelling. So that, you know, the TV is kind of an unconscious, like it's on because it's just been on for a long time. But to say, you know what, your children are going to so value your stories, the stories that you tell. Nobody else has those stories. There's a beautiful children's book called The Chalk Doll about a mother who tells her daughter the stories of her childhood on a Caribbean island, and she has this little doll, and she tells her the story. And, you know, to really encourage, even for all of you, if any of you are working with young people, to bring in your bag with you when you go on your tutoring some artifacts of your own life, to say, you know, I'm a storyteller. I'm going to tell you the story of my grandfather, or the story of when I was little and I walked in the park with my friend, or this funny thing that happened to me with my dog. Or, you know, children are just hungry for stories. And I think people put on TVs and other things when they're, it's just a distraction. It's like what you're, it's being accustomed. And I think that you know, Ben Franklin had the idea for a library. This was a genius idea because it was all free, and libraries are free. But the concern I have is you go to libraries now and there's hardly ever anybody in them. They're all sort of very quiet and empty, and I think we've got to revive that idea that you don't have to be the world's best reader to read to a child. You don't even have to know how to read with a child. And I think we have to be able to feel good about saying that, because there are lots of adults in this country who don't read that well and feel like there are other things that are just, let's just do that, or they're really stressed. They're coming home from work at 7 p.m. They've got to make dinner. They've got to get everything done. They've got to. But if we, from the very beginning, we can create environments, rituals, where let's put just a little basket, like in every pediatrician office, there should be, you know, a gift that's given, like what is that called in the hospitals? Where they give a reach out and read, I think, where they'll give out books. But I think there should be a message that's sent, you know, like a little basket of books can go in the kitchen or right at the high chair, so that the child from the very beginning understands that that print is really important. But not only print, the power of story, the power of language, your own story. Even if you don't have, you know, you don't have 1 minute to sit down, just while you're cooking, while you're standing there at the end of the day, sweating from work and all of that, just tell a story. Say, you know what, I'm going to tell you from when I was little. I'm going to tell you this one story. Because that helps build literacy, too. It helps with that. And I think, you know, the thing is like, you know those books, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective? You know, I keep thinking there should be something like the, you know, the habits, 4 habits of highly effective children. And really, they know what they are already. It's just, or maybe the title should be, of adults should pay more attention to the habits of highly effective children. But I would say, you know, imagination is one, and humor is another one, and curiosity is another, and reflection is the fourth. And if you could say to parents, as a pediatrician, as child psychiatrist, you could say, you know, we all want these things for our children. We want them to be imaginative and curious and reflective and humorous. These are things that they sustain us in bad times, you know. We want this. How can we get this? How can we do? What's it going to take to raise that child in that way? Yeah, Mel.
I have a quick question for you guys. I think I know where you might come down on it, but I'm curious to know what you think about Kindle, the Kindle phenomenon, and then also about I don't know if you guys heard this week. there's a spot on the local NPR affiliate here, WFCR, about, I think it's Cushing Academies, has built a new library, and it's completely paperless. Not just their card catalog online, which was a big deal when I was in college, but now all of their holdings, all their books are online. There are no books anymore at this library. It's more like a social hub. And I'm just curious to know how you both feel about that, because I've always thought of reading as such a tactile experience and a physical experience when you're with your children. I mean, they're snuggled up to you. I mean, there's that element of, you know, real human connection. So I'm curious to know what you guys think about that.
What do you think?
So I guess I would have to say, I think it'd be interesting to see how we respond and also how people respond 50 years from now, right? I mean, because I think that part of it is it is habitual. So it seems to me there's something wonderful about having a bookmark and marking one's progress and marking one's face. I think there's something magical about children learning to anticipate. So when children are just learning to read and are kind of following the words and then can tell when you turn the page. That sort of is this, you know, this moment of like, oh yes, I know when it is. And I think about children, you know, getting so much from the illustration, so much from the picture, so much from what else is going on. So it's hard for me to imagine that those things are going to be replicated in the same way in that form. But I also think there is a lot about what people are used to and what is familiar, and it'll be interesting to see if there are other ways in which that, in fact, becomes the same sort of ritualistic things.
I would agree with that. I think also we're probably in the Model T phase of the Kindle. So I mean, I love the idea of the Kindle because I travel a lot, and I used to bring like a suitcase full of books, and you know, you'd have to check that extra, and it was so unwieldy. And then, you know, I got the Kindle, and I was like, this is a miracle. You could put 1,000 books on here. And then, like, I was on a plane, and I'm trying to, like, and it was, like, the battery had died. And I was like, God damn it. Like,
right.
And, you know, so this is not good. But I think that the issue is what you're saying is that I think from years from now, or even not that long from now, I think that this literacy and technology conversation is going to be so different. Like when I was talking to my friend Phoebe, who's a children's book editor, she's like cringes when she thinks about technology and literacy because it's going to take away from the paintings in these children's books. But I think, you know, maybe we don't even know what, I mean, it might be that we read holographically and the images, like, you know, like Harry Potter, right? I mean, aren't there things that, right, the baseball cards or whatever that, and like the wizard cards, right? And they talk to them from the, I mean, it all seems crazy, but really, when you think about it, when I was at Amherst, there was one computer center, and it was like only just a few people went there, and it was like these really brilliant, like, math majors who went there, and I'd be like, you know, I'd like be walking with Justin to dinner, and I'd be like, so where are you going? And he'd be like, I'm going there. I'd be like, he's one of them. He's like, he's the computer wizard, you know? But now it's like everybody has a computer. Now it seems like nothing. And not to mention that cell phones didn't even exist. You know, when I was at Amherst, I'd like wait online at the phone to call my parents on a Sunday night. You know what I mean? You'd be waiting online, literally waiting online. And that was how you made a call. It was like we were in prison or something. Like once a week I can call home. But so that seems like so crazy. But I think that's what's going to happen. I think we're in the Model T phase. We're in the Model T phase. So we don't love the Kindle because it's awkward. We don't love it because it's not really the beauty of children's literature. But I think it's not going to stay like that. Do you know what I mean? And I personally, I've like lost all, you know, I feel like the more access we can get print to kids, the more access. And that question about, you know, is it really the stories of the people themselves? I feel like the more I understand that, the more I feel like any way we can get it, we've got to give it. Because, you know, remember when books were just calligraphy and only the wealthiest people had access to those beautiful books? There was no printing press. And that was like, the printing press must have seemed insane to, you know, that now we're going to be able to give these books just to everybody. In a way, I think that's kind of what we're at right now. Like, most of the world doesn't have access to books. Most of the world doesn't. And so if this can give us that sooner, then I'm all for that.
This strikes me as an interesting sort of ethical dilemma that we've also struggled with on the school board here. So I'll share this with you, which seems highly relevant. So the book fairs in Amherst have, in all the Amherst elementary schools, have included some, you know, classic literature. So you can buy, you know, Huckleberry Finn, or you can buy, you know, Lord Goes Wild or whatever. But there have also been sections that are, you know, Dora the Explorer or Hannah Montana Go Shopping or, you know, whatever that would be. And
And there has been real controversy between teachers, between parents, between librarians about should the book fairs be selling things that are so commercial. And some parents have said, absolutely, you know, we shouldn't include that, that that's a book fair, should be about literature, you know, it doesn't have to be high-level literature, but it shouldn't be something that is based entirely on a television or movie character. And then other parents have said, you know, my child won't read literature, but if Hannah Montana is on the front, my child will read it. And so I want the Hannah Montana, and I want, you know, this kind of thing, because that's what's going to be of interest to my kid, and it's going to, that my child will then be motivated to read it and is not going to be motivated to read, you know, another story. And that has been something that has really, you know, people have very strong emotions about, because it's really about, you know, are you valuing the printed word and whatever the printed word is fine, or are you not valuing all things sort of equally and accessibly? And I think everybody sort of has a vision of, in an ideal world, all children would gravitate towards the sort of more respected and classic literature and not this other stuff. And yet the reality is that lots of children walking through will say, wait, I like that book, and I like that book, and I like that book. And is that okay as long as they are reading? So it also strikes me as it's sort of a, you know, that is a bind. And it's a bind that, that, you know, teachers struggle with in terms of what to put in their classrooms, and their teachers who also have very strong feelings about what books they will and will not bring into their classroom as a result of that.
Well, I think, yes, I mean, this is a sort of an ongoing dilemma, like you say, both outside the classroom and inside. One thing is, I feel, again, to take the long view, as you say, I think that what I'm after is how we create that rich reading life for a child across time. And so with that, if you think about feeding a child or anything else that you do that would raise and nourish a child, the idea of it is balance, right? So if somebody came to my house at 11 p.m. and like saw what I'm reading at 11 p.m., which is generally People magazine, and said to me, I'm sorry, but that is not at your reading level, and took it out of my hand because it was too easy, haven't you read this before? That's such a waste of time. I would be a little ticked off because I like my People magazine at 11 p.m., do you know? And so I think part of it is that creating the life for the child, like Dora the Explorer, would I want that to be the only thing I read to children or shared with them? No. But at the same time, I want them to know that that has a role in their reading life. If that child is a struggling reader, for example, actually watching the show can help them build the prior knowledge, so they can then they can decode a harder word, because they can say, you know what, Explorer is a hard word. They can't read that word on their own, but they certainly know it because they have prior experience with it. Not to mention the fact that then they're part of the social culture. You know, everyone's talking about Dora, so they want to know what that is. And I think there's a reason. I think that's valid. I think that's valid. But I think that can't be the only, that's the idea of the balanced diet. We want to raise our children or teach our children or be role models. For those of you who are Amherst students, you want to be role models for children when you're interning or tutoring or mentoring. If you give them an unrealistic view of who you are, you're like, yes, I'm always reading my Psych 11 textbook every day, even after hours, I'm just browsing. That's ridiculous, you know? And so nobody, but they believe us. They totally believe us. We have to show them that we're real. We're really ingesting the cereal box, the Dora, and the Laura Ingalls Wilder. Well, yes. I mean, again, that kind of goes back to your first question.
Repeat the question.
Yes, sorry. Yeah. About reading in your first language and how important that is in terms of reading development and generally speaking, if that's important. Luckily, Spanish in this country, there are a lot of books that are written in Spanish or translated into Spanish. For other cultures coming in here or abroad, there's not that much children's literature that's in other languages. That's the problem. I think that it is, it's a dilemma. I don't really have an answer to it. I mean, there's just not enough written in lots of other languages for children. There's just not enough. I think, again, with the internet or with technology, there would be better like software that you could download and then it could translate into Swahili and French and Urdu, and you know, you could totally do that. And I think that's going to happen pretty soon too. And I think that will help children in their reading. I wish to say that those things exist right now for everybody, but since they don't, then I'm going to give children simple picture books in English because that's what I have. I'll use what I have.
I have a different response, but actually your question reminded me because it's you and you are here. And that is that one thing I did at Amherst in terms of the role of modeling, and so talking about the role of modeling and the role of modeling readers, and I think that's really the point of your question. Are you modeling television watching, right? Is that your modeling? And so I have two stories about modeling, one as a parent and one as a professor, which just really strike me as very important in terms of what we're showing children in a variety of ways. So one, every morning since I was in high school, I've read the New York Times. It is my ritual, and I get, freaked out if I'm on, vacation somewhere and I can't get it. And so every morning I get it. Every morning I sit and read. I have a bolster. My 11-year-old has now started doing that because I've been modeling, which, has led to interesting conversations, such as when we were in the car one day and he says, college students sure do stupid things, don't they? And I said, yes, because that's true. And I said, and why are you thinking that? And he said, well, like that student at Yale just killed somebody.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so there's so many things that, so then thinking bad modeling of that particular, and that was such a whole other discussion about how that was not a college student typical activity, or Yale, or, any many different things. So, I took it away from him then, but it was clearly that was just sort of his sort of ritual of what he was now watching us do. So I did something for the last couple of years that Amherst had started a program to try to increase intellectual life in the dorms. And so they had some faculty serving as faculty mentors or whatever in different dorms, which I think actually is now cut because of funding. But anyway, but it was good while it lasted. And so a program that I created that Jamie participated in was read a book and talk with the author. Read a book and talk with the author. So I got funding from the college to pass out paperback books, $15 a book. And I emailed students in Psych 11 in my dorm, and I said, anybody want to participate? And, 18, 20 students said, sure, I'd love to do that. And I invited, of course, Amherst is a rich area in which to invite authors. And so I contacted the authors first and said, would you be willing, to do this? And, of course, it's very nice for them to come in and talk to their book with a bunch of Amherst students. But the thing I really liked about it was that it wasn't for a class, it wasn't graded, they didn't have to write a paper on it, there wouldn't be a test, it was just your reading. You're just reading for fun, and you're getting to talk to the author. And so we had these great discussions, and Jamie was a participant in, which one were you in? Were it Stephen?
Friday Night Lights and the Psychological.
Oh, Friday, and the
wrong
one.
Man.
And the which one?
The Wrong.
Oh, The Wrong Man, yeah, right, okay, good. So, so we did that one, and then we did the year before I did one about an autistic boy that was a murder mystery. Right, so you did too. Yeah, so we would just talk with the author, and students had read this book and came in to just discuss it. And again, what I liked about it was the idea that you're reading something that's not required, because I feel so often in the college setting, there's so much reading. There is so much reading that it becomes sort of like reading is my job. Reading is my job, and it's not my pleasure. And so my thing was to be, this is about modeling. This is about modeling, reading books for fun, discussing them with people. And it was something that I really think students, found very rewarding and interesting. And it would always amaze me the number of students who would say, sure, I'll take on extra reading during the semester, although there won't be a test and there won't be a paper. I just want to do it.
And that starts from such a young age, too. I mean, I think our kids are getting a lot of messages right from the very beginning that there's an expectation around reading. When I watch in classrooms, in primary classrooms, where a teacher will read aloud to the children, and it's like this amazing book, and then she'll say, okay, so what happened in that story? And the kid will, raise his hand, maybe say something really, eccentric, kind of off. No. And she's like, no, no. And I'm like, just tell him then. Like, what do you want him to know? And the thing is, and it sort of just destroys, I mean, even that's not a paper, mm-hmm. but that sort of behavior is starting from this very early age. And so then we wonder why kids don't really like to read, because they're like, don't ask, And I think that's a problem, because that... maybe part of why when kids go to their laptops or just sort of get lost in their own world is because you do have more control. Nobody's going to come tap you on the shoulder and say, answer that question for me. Like, are you sure you got it? Was your comprehension 100%? And that, so how we as adults or young adults in this world can work with each other and with younger people as a mentor. And I mean, I just think that's amazing that you did that. Like, I wish that was still going on. That's fantastic. And that I think we can do that whether you're tutoring in town or you're or a parent yourself, but like what are the ways that we can enjoy conversation or going deeper around print and around the world stories in a way that doesn't feel like we're testing each other. Mm-hmm. You know, we're testing. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about when to read certain literature? My biggest question is reading over a child's comprehension level. My brother spoke about an experience as a kindergarten or pre-K even. He had a teacher who read them The Hobbit, and they went to a special little place, and they did it every day, and he was enthralled. Mm-hmm. Obviously not at his level at all, but the you know story itself created this love for him. So when do we read, and, you know...
It's a great question.
Yes, it is. Well, I am a big believer in the reason I love the read aloud so much is that you can elevate the level well before the child is actually reading at that level. And so for your brother, you know, The Hobbit is like this whole world. When I talk about at Children's Village, the boys are reading at a level, when you think about Dr. Seuss, but we're reading aloud to them from Harry Potter so that they too can be in that world. They have the access to that world. I would say that while that's true, I worry about that a little bit because your brother is probably a very intuitive, unique person. There are probably several other kids in that class that book might have been too hard for. I think that The Hobbit is hard for 5- and 6-year-olds to be read too. So there's a developmental progression in that also that I explored in my book. And as I was writing my book, I was like cringing the whole time because I said, everyone's going to be mad no matter what I write here because they're going to say, why didn't you include that book? And why didn't you include, you know? And so you can't ever be 100% right because for your brother, that was the right book at the right time. And for those of us who know our children in this room or know a child somewhere, part of it is the discovery of, is that book right for that child at that time? And only you both are going to know that. So, you know, I said to my daughter when she started reading some of the young adult books, And you know, some of those you worry about when they're reading independently. And I said, you know, if you get to a part that feels uncomfortable for any reason, just skip it. Like, go really fast. Go past it. You know, and she was like, well, is that all right? And I said, yeah, you can definitely do that. Because she was on the cusp. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't want to say to her, don't read that book. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was wanting to acknowledge. And I think the same is true for reading aloud, to say to our children, I'm going to read a chapter... And can we talk about let's talk about what we just read and listen very carefully to that dialogue because you'll know pretty fast. I was in a classroom the other day and this kid had a bookmark in his book and the teacher was like shaking her head. She said, he's had that bookmark there for like 3 days. So I went over and I said, can you tell me a little bit about the first chapter? Like, what happened? Can you tell me something about it? And he was like, not at all. Not at all. I was like, no wonder the poor kid, he's got like his bookmark. It's like he's done everything he's supposed to do except understand the book, you know? And he was just reading, it was too hard for him, that book. But the reading aloud, you could go up, you know, you could go up. But in terms of thematic content, you have to know your child, the inner sort of self of that child. Like Charlotte's Web is an incredible book, but it's also very painful. I mean, it's, you know, it's a really heartbreaking. And for a child who's a little too young, and death is a very complicated, confusing idea, for that particular child, maybe waiting until they're 9 to read that to them is a better idea than reading it at 7. And it really does depend on that child. That's why I love picture books, because they're written with that idea in mind. And there are picture books that are written with the older child in mind, that you're reading... Like, you know, I have brought a few samples you could take a look at after, but there are books that are written with pictures in them, but they're only 26 pages long, but they're very sophisticated themes about social justice and active reflection and being engaged with the world and meeting people you don't know and all these kinds of things. But they're 26 pages, so you could finish it and say, how did that feel? Like, what connections did you make to that book? I'd love to hear more about what you're thinking. And the main thing for me about literature is to always think about asking questions you don't know the answer to. Because I think as adults, as teachers, as professors, as parents, we often ask questions we already know the answer to or hope we're going to get. So it's like fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. rather than asking like a question that you really couldn't answer, like what are you wondering about, or what was a big idea for you in that story? Those are questions that I would never say are right or wrong, and they're very interesting to hear what kids are thinking. And most of the time, they're much deeper than we are. You know, that's the thing. I feel like I don't know if any of you have ever read the Mary Poppins, the books. Have any of you ever read them? And the books are so amazing. And there's a scene in one of them where there's a little bird and he sits outside the nursery and he watches over the children. And when they leave infant, they're not infants anymore, and then they become like toddlers and they're running around. Then they can't understand him anymore. He doesn't speak. And so Mary Poppins comes in because one of the babies is in the crib, but now he's like a two-year-old, and the bird has like a little tear coming down his cheek. And she says, "What's the matter?" And he says, it's over. You know, she can't understand me anymore. And that, I think, is true of childhood. I think we are visitors to that planet, and it's our privilege and honor to hear what they're thinking. But I think we always see it in reverse, like we are imparting knowledge to these poor, helpless, empty vessels of nothing. You know what I mean? And it's like, really, it's like that. And I feel like, you know, the sculptor, Brent Husey, you know, those beautiful birds. And I read something somewhere where somebody said, how do you make these birds? And he says, you know, I chip away at the stone until I find the bird in there. And that's how I feel about children. You know, they're there. It's just we have to figure out what are we doing to get there. And I think literature does that. Asking questions does that. Storytelling does that. Really nurturing the sense of, who are you? I really want to know. As not so much as, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know, and you better hear it right now. And that goes on, you know, even as our children are much older, you know, to restrain ourselves from, like, I'm just going to tell you everything I've learned, because, man, I learned a lot of stuff, you know what I mean? And instead to be like, I'm going to keep inquiring about this journey, because I'm going to learn something too. And that's very hard to do, because we are dying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it also really speaks to your question and your answer, the individual choices involved in what we like to read. And so we can all imagine, you know, for some people at late at night, it's People magazine. For some people, it's Sports Illustrated magazine. For some people, it's, you know, a trashy Jackie Collins book. Again, so it's different for different people. And I think that the best teachers my kids have had have recognized that. And I have really valued it when teachers give flexibility. So my son's sixth grade teacher now, who's fabulous, says every time they're choosing new books, he sets out three and he describes them. So you can read this one and it's kind of like this, and you can read this one and it's kind of like this, and you can read this one, and then you choose. And so, you know, Andrew this month chose Julie of the Wolves. And so that's what he's reading now. And then he has a friend who's reading a completely different book, and another friend who's reading a different book. And again, but his idea is making sure that all kids are captivated by something, again, that's compelling to them.
We have time for just one more question.
I just wanted to second that. I have a son who's a student here now, very bright kid, would never read a book unless he had to for school. Mm-hmm. It's very disappointing as a parent seeing this. And yet, he had a teacher who was so flexible, I think it was third or fourth grade, mm-hmm. had a 20-minute reading requirement. And the only requirement was that they were reading. It didn't even have to be a book. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, my son only reads Sports Illustrated. He's 7'5".
Mm-hmm. Right.
Your child can read 20 minutes of Sports Illustrated. I would count that as if it's a book. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. I could not agree more. I think that it's just we take away all choice from our kids and all a sense of that identity. That identity, my father has always said to me that the sports pages of the New York Times are the best written pages in the entire newspaper. He said that from the time I was really young. And I've always read those pages for that reason. I don't know anything about sports, but when I give speeches, I'm like constantly quoting these ball players. And people are like, and then afterwards, people will come up to me and say, hey, yeah, did you see the Yanks and the fifth inning? I'm like, no, that's going too far. That was just, yeah. But, I mean, it's that idea that we are all sort of snobbish about what we believe to be proper. And I'll just, to end with this idea that when we're building our children as readers, as thinkers, as reflectors, as being curious, as wondering, if they're with something that they already wonder about, then we're halfway there to taking that long view of who we really want to grow. And then also that they're mysterious to us. We don't really know what all their interests or passions are going to be. That's the thing I absolutely love about Amherst, is that you find yourself unpeeling and unfolding. You didn't know that part of you existed. You never even thought about that before. Well, that is the gift that this college gives to everybody who touches it. And that's the thing I wish more teachers would give earlier on. Because it's then, you know, that idea of passion, the unfolding of passion, and that's really, you know, that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, that's a lovely. I will end, my thing will be, I'm the faculty advisor to the men's hockey team here for a long, long time. I don't stay, same example, of course. And one of the challenges is that some of these kids, particularly the Canadian kids, have kind of come here. They've often played, you know, junior, semi-professional hockey for a few years. And I remember one of them sitting in my office last year, you know, trying to choose classes, and he had started the discussion saying, I don't care what I took. I took, you know, I took classes all throughout high school I didn't like, and, you know, it's all right. It doesn't matter. I mean, really, that was how he started. I said, we're going to aim a little higher here, you know. And then we start going through that, you know, well, there's anthropology, and there's art history, and I'm going through, you know, page by page or whatever, and he's sort of sitting there. I'm like, and there's this class, and I'm, like, reading a description of Barry O'Connell's class or, you know, Bill Zimmerman's class on evolution of human nature and biology, and I'm going through. And finally, you know, we have this whole discussion. He goes, you know, just... you know, talking to you, I get so excited that I think I might even want to take 5 classes. So, and it was this moment of, you know, and he was like, it's just, and it was really that he hadn't thought about it that way. You know, and I think, like, you only get 32 here, you know, you got it, really, you know. And it was this moment of him sort of understanding, you know, that excitement, you know, about learning and taking the classes and finding that passion that really, you know, as he arrived, he said pretty much, you know, choose 4, whatever. You know, and again, having this real shift. And that is, I think that's really the essential piece of Amherst, of reading. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you for coming.
Just wanted to let you all know that Catherine and Ken will both be signing books if you'd like. Their books are available right outside. It's all fine. It looks like you also brought some things to...
Yeah, I also brought cards for... We're going to have World Read Aloud Day on March 3rd. If anyone's interested in joining in, please take a card and pass the word. Okay, well, that was...